Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Mr. Ronald Chapman II, chairman of Chapman Law Group, located in Michigan. He's the author of the book, Fight the Feds, Unraveling Federal Criminal Investigations, which is available for pre-order now, and a Kindle version, and the paperback and hardback versions will be available on January 7th. And so with that, I'd like to welcome Mr. Chapman. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me here today. I appreciate the invite.
Well, certainly. You have certainly been a big name in many prominent opioid litigations over the past few years, as well as other healthcare fraud related litigation. For those of you who may not be familiar with you or your law firm, can you tell a little bit about yourself and the law firm Chapman Law Group?
Absolutely. So I started my legal career in the United States Marine Corps. I was originally going to be part of the regular line forces of the Marine Corps, and then I had a particularly interesting college class in the philosophy of law that got me very interested. So I switched my contract over to law and decided to pursue a career in the Marine Corps as an attorney. And while I was there, I spent a lot of time in the prosecutor's office. So I would prosecute cases, anything from detainee issues. I was in Afghanistan for a while, and we would take detainees on the battlefield and in some cases prosecute them. But then I also moved forward to prosecuting federal offenses committed by military service members while on, you know, bases, Marine Corps bases, Navy bases, and whatnot. During my time in the prosecutor's office, I started to realize very quickly that the tools that prosecutors have available to them make it so that you could really convict just about anybody you want to of just about anything you want to. And I didn't like the unequal balance of power. So after racking up a significant number of convictions, all ethical, of course, I didn't engage in some of the tricks and tactics that I saw my counterparts engage in, but I elected to come out into private practice. And I wanted to focus in an area where the federal government rubs up against our constitutional rights as much as possible. And I found healthcare to be the right area. And my father's had a healthcare law firm for probably about 35 years. And so I approached him about opening up a criminal section of the law firm that would solely be devoted to defending healthcare entities from federal prosecution. That includes individual doctors, pharmacists, and other health professionals, but also healthcare corporations. And I found that given the development of the so-called opiate epidemic and the way that physicians have been pursued, that I was able to put myself into, you know, one of the fastest growing areas of federal criminal defense, but also an area where the government is exercising more overreach than in probably any other area of criminal law. So for the last 10 years, that's what I've been doing, defending good doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and health professionals and companies against what has become a very powerful federal government.
Yeah, certainly, Mr. Chapman, you have been uniquely successful in this space. You talk about your military experience, and you also talk about your interest in the philosophy of law. Mm-hmm. From those two perspectives, both your experience and your learnings, do you see something unique about healthcare law that predisposes to government overreach?
Yeah, that's actually a fantastic question and hits right at the heart of the matter. You know, when you look at the philosophy of law and crime and punishment, typically we have criminal laws to protect society and in some cases to protect the government and public institutions from fraud and corruption. But what criminal laws were never supposed to be designed to do is to be a coercive arm of the government to get people to engage in certain conduct that isn't inherently unsafe to the population or dangerous to the population. And that's exactly what we've done with our criminal laws. So I describe this in the book and also on my webpage, contrafed.com. Back in 1780, we had 30 criminal laws on the books. Going to the 1980s, we had about 3,000 criminal laws on the books. Now, with the incorporation of healthcare fraud, healthcare rules and regulations, securities rules and regulations, maritime rules and regulations into the laws, we have almost 300,000 laws on the books and climbing. Many of those most recent developments don't contain a criminal intent requirement, meaning they're strict liability. And I talk about this in the book as well, which means that stepping outside the line of conduct in these rules and regulations could lead you to anywhere from an administrative punishment to criminal indictment. And the person that gets to make the decision as to which one you go into, which box you fall into, is the prosecutor. We've seen an expansion of prosecutorial discretion in our country, such that almost anything can be a violation of federal criminal law. And the prosecutor gets to decide how many crimes to stack on a defendant, how much time to give that defendant. And we have a lot of good federal judges in our country who care about the law, but a lot of them are rendered, I guess, almost useless because of the way these statutes have been created and they have to adhere to them. I write about an example in the book of a fisherman who was fishing in off the coast of Honduras and caught a bunch of lobsters. He packaged those lobsters into plastic bags, not into boxes. And Honduras law requires a certain packaging for these types of lobsters. Strange to be talking about lobsters and criminal law at the same time, but that's the position our country has put us in now. So he imports those lobsters into the United States. And there's a statute in the United States that says if you violate a foreign fishing law and import those fish into the United States, you can be guilty of a federal crime. So what this law does is not just criminalize violations of United States regulations that are not criminal laws, but they're just regulations, but it also incorporates all other national laws of other countries and their regulations and says that violating those can now be a violation of US law. That person was convicted of improperly importing lobsters because of the packaging based off an interpretation of Honduran law. Now, some people and probably those in your audience would say, why the heck are we criminally prosecuting these people? Why don't we civilly fine them? Well, that's where our federal government is these days. In the healthcare context, failing to properly bill something incident to or using the wrong E&M code can result in a federal prosecution for fraud. And in many other areas, we see this. And that's exactly why I wrote Fight the Feds, Unraveling Federal Criminal Investigations. I want people to understand this broad expansion of prosecutorial discretion, but I want to be able to show the average citizen and the criminal defendant and the attorney what they can do to fight back and how they can really help their clients or help themselves navigate this government. And for the citizen who isn't facing any problems, I just think that people should be aware of this issue. And we talk a lot about that on contrafed.com as well.
Yeah, one of the things you've been particularly astute at noting is this concept of the negative rights, almost where you should have known certain behaviors and the absence thereof then substitutes any sort of meaning of intent. Why do you think healthcare is particularly predisposed to that line of prosecutorial investigation?
Well, it's because the government pays the bill for healthcare. And that's usually where we see them enact these sorts of laws or regulations. The way that healthcare fraud statutes have been expanded, and I think we need to go back and look at that first, is you have this crime 1347 and 1349 that says it's unlawful to defraud a federal healthcare program. So what does fraud mean? Fraud usually means trying to get something that's a benefit to you by using misrepresentation or deceit. Well, the misrepresentation in healthcare fraud cases is usually the submission of a claim. So when any health professional, as you know, when any health professional submits a claim or signs up to bill, let's say Medicare, they have to sign this form called an 855I. And that form says, I will abide by all the rules and regulations of Medicare. I've often wanted to do this. If you were to take all of the rules and regulations on Medicare and federal healthcare programs and put them on a cart and wheel them into the courtroom and say, every defendant is required to follow every one of these, you wouldn't just have one cart, you'd have many. In fact, you'd probably be filling the courtroom with manuals and guides.
Certainly.
And so because physicians, healthcare providers have to sign this 855I, they are certifying that they know these regulations and that they will follow them. And of course, it's impossible to know all these regulations. Years and years of study and additional degrees have been obtained by people in the compliance industry, and they still don't understand many of these rules and how they play out. They're anything but clear. So the reason why it was done this way is simply to allow the government a vehicle to get money back from people who are accused of overbilling the federal government and to coerce health professionals into compliance. Now, some may ask, why doesn't the government just civilly sue people or go after them for audits and overpayments? Well, something else happened around that time. Civil penalties are very difficult for the government to get. You have to sue somebody. There's depositions. There's a full hearing. The civil world gives us a lot more tools available to us, or gives us a lot more tools to be able to fight back, because we can know what the witnesses are going to say. We can depose them. The civil rules aren't that favorable to the government, but the criminal rules are incredibly favorable to the government. You can proceed with a secret grand jury where nobody knows what's being talked about in the grand jury. You can indict under that same secrecy. You can withhold discovery up until the eve of trial and spring it on people. In some cases, in many cases, like the Senator Stevens case that I talk about in the book, they withhold discovery willingly and never produce it. It's more likely to happen when a defendant doesn't have a lot of rights to get discovery. It's a lot easier to coerce somebody into accepting a plea and paying a lot of money back when you pursue them criminally than when you pursue them civilly. So over the course of the last 15 years, more so in the last 7 years, we saw the rates of criminal prosecution increase. The rates of civil prosecution didn't increase that much. And we start to see that federal prosecutors are using criminal statutes as a tool because they're much easier and much more coercive.
You know, a counter argument people will turn to, and particularly those who may not be as well versed in the legal world as you, would be to cite the Fourth Amendment, or cite some sort of right to privacy. How does the government overcome these? Because I know you discussed these quite extensively in some of your other writings. How does the government overcome some of these basic privacy and protections that most people assume we have?
Well, the Fourth Amendment and many of the other protections have been slowly eroded by the Supreme Court. I think that we are getting some traction in getting those rights back. But let's take a look at cell phone seizure. You know, most people keep most of their information now in a cell phone. Back when the framers of the Constitution wrote the Constitution, they never contemplated such a large amount of data being stored in a single place before. And there's text messages and there's emails inside of these phones. And when a prosecutor wants to search a cell phone, the entirety of the cell phone, all they need to do is issue a warrant under probable cause and say that there might be some evidence located in this particular place. And that's pretty easy when you're arguing healthcare fraud. So all you have to do is bring an agent before a judge, have that agent say, we suspect healthcare fraud because their billing is statistically higher than their peers, or we've noticed a couple of claims that we believe to be false. And then they get a warrant pretty easily. And with that warrant, they can then pierce into some of the most private matters of somebody's life and, sort of Fourth Amendment be damned. Now, the Fourth Amendment is being walked back a little bit. There was a recent case, Carpenter, where they tried to use cell site location by just requesting it to be able, and I write about this in the book as well, to be able to figure out the location of people involved in a robbery scheme of cell phone stores. And the Supreme Court said, no, without a warrant, you can't get cell site location for a whole bunch of phones at the same time. So we are seeing some relief from the court here, but these rights have been eroded a lot, and it's much easier to prosecute these days because of that erosion of rights.
Yeah, you mentioned two key things that I think are important to expound upon. One is the technology, and two is the use of statistics in many ways to identify probable cause or circumvent traditional due process. Talk about, in your experiences, the ways technologies and statistical databases are being misused by the government to go after individuals.
Well, with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, we saw something called meaningful use come into play, which is the bane of many physicians' existence, right? Meaningful use required that those billing federal healthcare programs have an electronic medical record system available to them. And the reason why that requirement was put into place was, for the most part, government surveillance. With an electronic medical record, the government would have the ability to scan a large volume of files, requiring billing to be sent electronically, as opposed to the old CMS Form 1500, allowed the federal government to be able to scan billable entries very quickly for healthcare programs. And so what we were creating with meaningful use is this ability for the government to engage in large-scale surveillance. So as a result of that, and PDMPs, prescription drug monitoring programs going into place, the federal government now has data on every claim that is submitted. They can request medical records and get an analysis done on all of the treatment that a patient receives. And in addition, they can also request a PDMP report showing all of the drugs that they received. And they can smash all that data together, and they do. Entities like Clarent, Palantir are big data aggregation companies that will then scan that data to find which physicians were more likely to be engaged in healthcare fraud. And here's the problem with the big data approach. It's the tail wagging the dog. The assumption is made that the physician who is doing more is more likely to be criminal. The assumption is made that if a physician is engaging in more red flag behavior, that they're criminal. Well, red flags are only as good as the evidence that actually shows that people who exhibit these red flags are criminals, right? So when we look at opiate prescribing, they may look at a sample of patients and say, well, this physician has a lot of patients who traveled far, went to multiple providers, which is doctor shopping, high amounts of controlled substances. Those red flags could be evidence of a pill mill, certainly, right? But it also could be evidence that maybe this physician is a compassionate physician operating in an area where there's not a lot of pain management physicians, and maybe they're appropriately treating the pain of a very impacted patient population that needs good pain management. So when we see the government engage in this statistical approach to be able to target people for prosecution, oftentimes what happens is, once — I read a lot about confirmation bias in the book — once the government believes that somebody has committed a crime, they will pursue that person and largely ignore evidence to the contrary because they've already formulated that belief in their mind. So once the report of statistical information about a particular provider is sent to a prosecutor or investigators, those investigators will be hot on the tail of that physician, and they will ignore all other evidence to the contrary. And that's just human nature, all right? So confirmation bias starts to set in, and then that person becomes targeting. The only response by physicians is to either act differently by keeping your head low and keeping your data clean, which is what most physicians have chosen to do, or increase your compliance. And even though you might be engaging in behavior that puts you on a little bit of a different area of the risk profile, you could increase your compliance and make sure that if the federal government does come knocking, you have that available to you. So about a year ago, I started up a company, Chapman Consulting Group, that works along with Chapman Law Group. And that's designed to help providers before they get in the crosshairs of the government so that we can ratchet up their compliance if they are engaging in sort of high risk practices. And we've been successful in doing that, which has been great.
Yeah, no, certainly you provide a unique philosophical bent to a lot of your analysis of law. If we were to kind of pursue that and put on your philosophical hat, your behavioral economist hat, and talk about confirmation bias as you allude to in your book.
Yeah.
These arguments of using technology and statistical databases are what are called inductive arguments. Can you talk about inductive arguments, first providing an explanation as you understand it, and then talk about why they're so common in healthcare litigation, particularly criminal litigation?
I think I'll first answer the second question. I think that they're so common because it's easy.
Yeah.
Because we have prosecutors who have two options. They can either go through traditional beat cop police methods and interview witnesses, or they can sit in front of a computer and collect data and aggregate it and find people to target. And it's very easy to be able to look at the data and then pursue those leads. And it's very difficult to not use that inductive reasoning, as you say, and start assuming that those people who are caught up in the data are guilty, and to be able to put the brakes on it. And really, the way that we solve this problem is twofold. The first thing that we need to do is we need to have better judicial decision making on issues like mens rea and intent. So that in order to be guilty of a federal crime, a prosecutor must show that that defendant intended to defraud, not just intended to violate some obscure billing requirement of Medicare. We should only be prosecuting people who are trying to scam the federal government, not people who are making honest mistakes. And unfortunately, that's not been the case lately. But the second thing that we need to do is we need to have citizens get involved in the proper allocation of government resources and stop this sort of inductive reasoning from taking hold and holding their government responsible for pursuing investigations that actually make society safer. We have the highest prison population that we've ever had in the United States. I think we trump nearly every country in the world in terms of prison population. The conditions aren't good. The federal resources towards law enforcement aren't good. And for some reason, instead of focusing on violent crime, we've decided to focus on large-scale political prosecutions. We've started to focus on SEC violations. We've started to focus on healthcare fraud, when a lot of these things really are better in the civil enforcement action as opposed to the criminal indictment. I understand that a lot of US attorneys and a lot of attorneys general want to make headlines. They want to show that they're taking down dirty doctors, which means they have to start creating some dirty doctors in order to take them down. And that's what they've been using the statistics to do and this inductive reasoning to do.
Interesting about the political angle, because I don't think there is a society as litigious or politically charged as we are right now. In your book, you talk about Kyle Rittenhouse, and you talk about the acquittal in the case. For those of you who may not understand some of your writings that are publicly available on Medium or your website, talk to us a little bit about how you discuss the case in your book.
Yeah, so I won't shy away from a controversial topic. And when I actually decided to include a discussion of the Kyle Rittenhouse case in the book, I did put a lot of thought into it because there's a lot of emotion behind the case. But that case is discussed really in the part of the book where we discuss the need for consistency for a prosecution. And whether or not you thought Kyle Rittenhouse was guilty, I think that everybody deserved more from that prosecution team, either in the decision-making on whether or not they should charge or on the decision-making on whether or not they should try the case. One thing I learned early on as a prosecutor is that if you decide to charge a case, you need to do it knowing all of the information. And you need to, if you're going to charge a case, you better win the case, because the prosecutor is the first line of the justice system. They should be refusing cases if they don't have enough information to prosecute, or if they're not absolutely certain that they can get a conviction. Prosecutor conviction rates should be 97%, but they shouldn't be 97% because they're so good at manipulating the law and the judges go their way almost every time, and so innocent people are caught up. They should be 97% because they are only pursuing the people who are clearly guilty. And that's a step that was missed in the Rittenhouse case. They proceeded based on public outcry, all right? Now, I just wrote an article, I think I'll get it to you soon, about Korematsu, and Rittenhouse and Korematsu actually have a lot in common here. Fred Korematsu, back in the 1940s, was a Japanese American, ultimately went up to the Supreme Court with his case, who avoided internment. He eventually was captured, and he was forced into an internment, and I'll abbreviate this case a bit, but one of the reasons why America decided to abandon the Constitution in the 1940s was because there was a lot of saber rattling against the Japanese. There were a lot of press reports about fear of Japanese attacks. There were people in the Department of Justice and Hoover at the FBI was also talking about the potential of Japanese spies operating within the United States. Now, none of that ended up being true, but at that time, the public sentiment was so against the Japanese that any legislature and any congressman could have put forward just about any law impacting Japanese citizens, and the United States public would have gone for it. But as I think Kennedy said, we need to be judged for what we do for the least of our citizens. You know, we really need to be careful when we're making decisions amid a large-scale public outcry and hysteria. We need to be careful about how we're operating amid the Black Lives Matter protests and who we're charging and who we're indicting. We need to be very careful when we feel like we're making decisions for political motivations as opposed to doing what we need to do. And when we do approach those junctures, we need to fully evaluate the Constitution and the facts of the case and the law at hand to make sure the right decision is being made. And whether or not you support Kyle Rittenhouse, whether or not you thought he was heinously guilty or absolutely innocent, the country is divided on that. What we all should expect of our government is a prosecution team that makes a decision free from hysteria and with complete facts and knowledge of the law. And that's why I write about it, because I think it is a charged issue, just as Korematsu was back in the 1940s. But I think those are the moments, those are the teachable moments for us as a society.
Yeah, Mr. Chapman, you have certainly been among many able to discern the process from the outcome. And I think that you've been no stranger to controversial cases yourself in many ways related to healthcare fraud and in the opioid epidemic. Many of these high profile cases that you've taken on and quite often have won, or at least have had rulings in your favor, how were you able to discern the proper constitutionally sound mechanisms from the political outcry and outrage surrounding all the legality?
Well, you know, I wish that we could just be armed with the Constitution and walk into court and say that this isn't right. But unfortunately, that's not good enough these days, because prosecutors are people, judges are people, juries are people. Everybody has their own opinions, motivations, biases, and they don't want to allow themselves to believe the counter narrative, even if it smacks them in the face, right? And I write about this in the book extensively. We've really got to approach people where they are. So, for instance, not too long ago, we won an injunction against CVS, the first ever injunction in the country on behalf of a doctor named Kendall Hansen. CVS sent him a letter, like they've sent letters to many doctors throughout the country, and said, "We're cutting you off, and none of your patients will be able to fill at CVS." Well,
prescription opioids.
Yep, that's right. Well, most of his patients went to CVS, and most of them were required to go to CVS because they actually had contracts through their employer with CVS. Or if they switched pharmacies, no other pharmacy would take them because they were associated with now a doctor who was cut off. Again, sort of the tail wagging the dog. Well, he immediately became an unpopular figure. In that area, people assumed that because CVS cut him off, there should have been some truth to it. But when we dug deeper, we realized that the basis for CVS's decision was not based on anything other than the fact that CVS learned that this doctor was under federal investigation. So mere investigation and suspicion led CVS to take an action that impacted the rights of many patients. So we could have gone into court and defended the doctor, but we didn't do that. What we did was we defended the patients. And we said, you know, listen, judge, we've got a lot of patients here that are going to be ripped away from their chosen provider because they're already in these contracts, or they won't be able to get their medication and they're in pain. And I wish we could look to them and say, the reason that this action was taken was because CVS did a thorough investigation, determined that this is a illegitimate clinic and that there are bad practices going on. But CVS never did that. And what they instead decided to do is impact the rights of a broad swath of patients without looking into anything based on speculation. That was the narrative that really rang home for the judge. And in the pretrial hearings on that case, he actually turned to CVS and said, "What evidence do you have for impacting the rights of so many of these patients?" And so The reason why I say that is because there's two sides to every coin. And where the government is saber rattling, saying pill mill, pill mill, pill mill, we have this other group of people that need to have a voice too. And that's the pain patients in the United States, or the general population of the United States who deserves to have adequate healthcare that's not interfered with by their own government. And so we have to fight fire with fire. We have to create a narrative, and not really a narrative, because a narrative suggests that that's more rhetoric. This is all truth. We need to go to the court, and we need to really give that voice. We need to do it in the press. We need to do it in court. We need to do it when we're communicating with the prosecutor. And we need to show them that there's more to this than just speculation of illicit activity.
Well, Mr. Chapman, you mentioned all of that, and it sounds very good, at least in theory, but it's very difficult for people to kind of stand up and implement that in practice. You are uniquely qualified because not only are you responding to the many false narratives of the purported opioid epidemic, but you're also making news with these legal cases. From your perspective, talk to the audience about this balance between the legal rulings and the public perceptions and how they kind of reverberate.
Yeah, you know, this comes from my time as a prosecutor. As a prosecutor, we would always release a press release when we had a victory in a case, and the government certainly likes to tout their victories. So when I joined the defense bar and became a defense attorney, I noticed that a lot of defense attorneys would avoid public comment for fear of staking a claim to the case, for fear of making some sort of public presentation about their belief in the case. And I don't think that that's correct. When I sit down with a client and I understand where they're coming from and what happened, I feel like my job is to get that narrative out there in front of anybody who will listen in order to try to make sure that the press that is generated from the federal government receives a response. I believe that an attorney saying no comment is an attorney saying my client's likely to plead guilty, right? So in just about every one of these cases, when the reporters call me, I pick up the phone and I talk to them, provided my client is okay with that. But most are. When a significant ruling happens, I reach out to my press contacts and I let them know. Because I think that the silence in this arena has been brought about mostly because attorneys are afraid to talk and afraid to advocate in the public space for their clients. And we're not afraid to do that. I'm certainly not afraid to do that. And I think it's a really important part of this. Without people like you getting the word out, people like Claudia Morende, even Linda Cheek, who's, you know, got Doctors of Courage, other people who are willing to make a little noise, I think that we are seeing as a country a different view in the public of the opiate epidemic. And in this most recent case against Dr. Hansen, I've had reporters call me up for comment and they would just say, you know, sort of as an aside, hey, I really like that guy and I support him and, you know, we're not going to trash him in the press. And that means that public opinion is changing and we need to seize on that. Mm-hmm. And now with the Supreme Court granting cert in a couple of cases, this has become something thrust into the public lexicon. And I think will be something talked about. So we have room to talk and I think we all should and continue to join in the conversation.
Yeah. From your perspective, where will the inflection point come? Will it come from a legal ruling or will it come from public perception influencing a ruling? And I know they're not mutually exclusive, but I'm kind of trying to decipher where the pressure gradient is most profound.
Yeah, it actually will come from both. So it's a mix of the two. The Supreme Court is, I talked about this on the podcast yesterday with Sean Weiss. If you haven't heard it, Coffee and Compliance, it's a great show. And I was a guest there. And one of the things I told Sean when we were talking about the New York vaccine ruling is that the Supreme Court doesn't have its own police force. It doesn't have its own government. It doesn't have its own protection. And it really relies on other institutions in the government to follow its rulings for its power, right? The Supreme Court is powerless unless we follow the law and unless people fully and faithfully execute the law. So they're very weary of stretching too far outside of public opinion. They sort of have these guideposts, right? If they decided Dred Scott, a slavery decision, and then later on they reversed that, partly because public perception at the time was somewhat pro-slavery and then changed. I'm not saying that it was right that they did that, but I think that they fear a public revolt if they stretch too far, right?
Certainly.
So that's exactly what we have here with opiates. The Supreme Court waited 45 years to take up a case of a prescriber. Nothing has been decided by them since United States versus Moore on the issue of prescribing. And they're partly doing it because the public conversation has changed through the work of a lot of people. There's a lot of authors, Steve Ziegler, who we're writing an amicus on behalf of, a lot of scholarly writing that has gone up to the court, really helped the court understand that the public perception and the narrative has changed. And also, it's evidence that the government has pushed too far into a particular territory. So they have these parameters of public opinion. And then within those parameters of public opinion, they have to make a decision. Now, I believe the inflection point is and has always been a decision by the Supreme Court regarding the standard for convicting a physician for unlawful prescribing. When we're talking about healthcare, that is the one thing that will correct the entire system and go all the way down. Unfortunately, and I'll give you a little preview I haven't given to anybody else yet. Unfortunately, I don't believe that that the two cases that the Supreme Court granted cert on are the cases in which that will happen. The Supreme Court was faced with three cases that they could have potentially granted cert on: United States versus Noum, United States versus Ruan, and United States versus Kahn. Ruan and Kahn were limited to whether or not a physician should receive a good faith instruction, an instruction that if they practiced in good faith, that they can't be found guilty. Noum was a larger issue, whether or not a physician could be convicted if he prescribed for a legitimate purpose, but the government argued that he prescribed outside the course of professional practice. The Supreme Court took Ruan and Kahn, cases with very problematic facts, and elected to grant cert on those cases while holding Noum in the balance. The issue of good faith is not an issue that resolves the entire question, and it doesn't fix the entire problem. But again, justice moves slowly. Maybe they give us some benefit here, and maybe we wait a little bit and they give us some more benefit when things continue to change or when the government doesn't back off after this ruling. They're really feathering the pedal of justice here, and I understand why they're doing it, but my concern is that we have millions of people subjected to unnecessary pain in this country. It's become its own epidemic, and I think we've got to get the court to act as quickly as possible.
Well, that is certainly interesting, the way the Supreme Court will look at these issues, and particularly from your standpoint, being one of the most prominent attorneys in this space. If you had to project how 2022 and 2023 would play out with many of the prominent cases still in the mix, Walmart v. DOJ, the Sackler case now being revived, what sort of trends will you see in the lower courts, given that the Supreme Court is at least now starting to give this issue a hearing?
Well, yeah, I've got a real world example of that. I was just in a hearing yesterday, United States versus Lewis, a case of an interventional pain physician who's being indicted. Dr. Bothra is a prominent physician who's also involved in that indictment. It's out of the Eastern District of Michigan. And the trial court is having a really tough time balancing the fact that the Supreme Court is going to make a decision on opiate prescribing cases soon. And he's not sure how to wrestle with the decisions that he has to make while this case is pending trial in the shadow of the Ruan and Kahn decisions. And he gave, I think, the defense a lot of leeway in some of our motions and maybe a lot of benefit of the doubt, because he knew that there's a possibility that the Supreme Court may roll in our direction. So things will become slightly kinder to physicians, given that somebody's gotten some traction up in the court. It may not get us all the way there. And certainly the court may not go in our direction. That's up to them. I think that they partially will. But I also think that it's not going to provide the measure of clarity that we're all hoping for. And so we'll just be wrestling with a different problem after the court acts. We'll be wrestling with interpreting their decision.
That's interesting, because now the issue translates from interpretation one way to an interpretation another way. And it always seems like with these healthcare restrictive laws that try to just confine or bind one particular act, it's consistently moving back and forth, almost like a dialectic between different interpretations. So you're projecting that instead of a resolution, we may have a substitution of interpretation.
Exactly. And that's how our country operates. And in fact, that's how we need to operate, right? One political party gets in the White House and swings things one way. Another one swings it another way. Our system is preserved because we have these wild shifts that somehow continue to find a middle and a path through. That's probably much better than a long-term dictator who gets to pull in the other direction. So America was designed to be divisive, and that friction was supposed to cause democracy to filter through and justice to filter through. And the same thing with the laws of our country. We see post-Enron, the government comes out really hard on companies, prosecuting the hell out of them under conspiracy laws. And then we see the court slap their hands a couple of times in, 2008, 9, and 10. Opiate epidemic happens. We see prosecutors push really hard. And then the court may smack them down in 2021 or 2022 a little bit for pushing too hard. And I think that's how our system operates, unfortunately. That makes many of our citizens cannon fodder, which is incredibly unfortunate. And it's the one thing that gets me waking up in the morning and putting on my suit and going to court every day, because I want to defend those good people from, the impact of these swings in our process.
Yeah, and one of the things we can do is empower ourselves by learning about the issues, which is what you allude to in your book. And so before we let you go, can you summarize what the audience can expect in reading Fight the Feds, Unraveling Federal Criminal Investigations, and where they can find the book?
Absolutely, and thank you for the opportunity to do that. First and foremost, I wrote the book to be fun. There's a lot of very interesting cases that have come out of the Supreme Court and the lower district courts. A reader of this book will learn about the Enron prosecutions. They'll learn about issues in the Rittenhouse case. We'll talk a bit about Korematsu and Japanese internment. We'll talk about prosecutorial abuses and ineffective counsel. There's going to be plenty of war stories shared in the book, and not really my war stories, more so some of the most prominent cases. I think I talk about the Oklahoma City bombing a little bit. So when you put down the book, you will walk away with a knowledge of some of the most important criminal cases that have developed our laws over the last 100 years. But threaded through those cases will be a lot of legal lessons that will help people understand the investigative stage. Now, I could have sat down and wrote a book about trial, but that wouldn't be that helpful, because most federal cases don't go to trial. In fact, only about 3% of those cases go to trial. Cases are won or lost based on the investigative stage. I just sat with somebody recently who told me their attorney elected not to engage in a pre-indictment investigation because they didn't want to poke the sleeping bear. And I write about that in my book, because the federal government is anything but a sleeping bear. They're a snowball of justice that rolls down the hill and crashes into anything that gets in its way, and usually causing some pretty severe damage. So I decided to write about the investigative stage so that people could understand the tricks of how the government tries to flip cooperators and have them provide sometimes very coerced testimony against people. I talk about General Flynn and how the FBI did a walk-up interrogation of a man who was very well protected in the federal government and got him to sing and make admissions against himself. And I expose a lot of the dirty tricks that the FBI and other government agencies use against defendants during the investigative stage to win the case before it even starts. And my hope is that this gets into the hands of people who will read it and talk to their friends and learn what they can do when faced with the power of the federal government to make sure that they don't end up in the path of that snowball when it's huge, and that they might be able to stomp it out when it's a lot smaller earlier on in the fight.
No, certainly this is something that I would recommend all of our listening audience to get. It's Fight the Feds, Unraveling Federal Criminal Investigations. It's available on Amazon in Kindle version, available as we speak. And on January 7th, it'll be available in print, both paperback and hardback copy. And with that, Mr. Chapman, I'd like to thank you so much for your time and look forward to all your successes in 2022 and beyond.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure speaking with you. And likewise, I wish you all the success in the new year.
Okay, take care.
Thanks.